Welcome to the ADHD Alchemy Podcast, where women with ADHD finally feel seen, understood, and unapologetically themselves. If you have ever felt like you're too much and not enough all at the same time, you're in the right place because that's the alchemy, learning how both come together to make something priceless. I'm Jessica Covington, holistic ADHD coach and fellow fancy brain, and I'm really glad you're here. Let's get into it. Welcome to ADHD Alchemy. It's more than a podcast. It's also my signature coaching program at Fitology. It's perfect for bright, sensitive women who are tired of feeling scattered and chaotic and ready to feel calm, clear, and finally in control. Inside the program, whether it's group or private, we tone down the harsh inner critic, break old patterns of procrastination and self-sabotage, and start redefining ADHD on your own terms. So in just a few weeks, you'll find yourself more grounded, confident, and leading your life with intention by learning to work with your fancy brain instead of against it. If that speaks to you, find more at fitology.com. And that link, of course, will be in the show notes. As you know, if you've been around here a while, most of this podcast is about stories from women just like us who have fancy brains. But every now and again, I like to include perspectives from experts who are doing great work in neurodiversity and supporting our needs. And I'm thrilled today to talk with, to me, a giant in that field, somebody I really look up to personally. So excuse the superfan excitement as I introduce Dr. Matthew Zakreski. Known to us today as Dr. Matt, he's a seasoned clinical psychologist and professional speaker, renowned for his expertise in serving neurodivergent individuals. His talks are attended by people of all ages and backgrounds, and have inspired leaders from a variety of industries. Dr. Matt combines a strategic approach with an outside-the-box perspective to help people reach their goals. Passionate about reducing stigma surrounding neurodiversity, Dr. Matt is driven by his mission to promote a culture of compassion and understanding in order to support people in embracing and celebrating their unique brains and ways of operating in the world. Dr. Matt, thank you so much for being here.
It is my great pleasure. Thank you for the lovely introduction, by the way. It is so weird to me. Like, it's like the best definition of the word bemused, like that I have fans. And there's no false modesty here. It's like, wait, what? It boggles my mind that people, anybody listens to me in the first place. I mean, right? But when they do. They find value in it enough that, like, you think that you're a fan. I mean, so I don't know. To me, it's just like, if what I'm putting out there is helping someone, then I'm doing my job. And if it's helping you enough that you're like, oh my gosh, I get to talk to this person, I'm just going to sit here. When I get embarrassed, my ears turn red. So you can't really see them because my hair is a little long right now. But trust me, my ears are bright pink at the moment.
That's awesome. I think that's a sign you're really in alignment and doing the exact work that you're doing here. The idea that you have fans just for doing what you do naturally. It's beautiful.
I like to think so. But I mean, you know, I just, as someone with ADHD myself, the fact that you center shame in this process is so vital to me. I mean, growing up, I always sort of thought something else was wrong with me because of the emotionality that comes with being ADHD. I'm like, oh, I must have some other thing. Right. But I mean, then you dig into the research and you know, there's all this emotional volatility and there's all those shame spirals and the RSD and everything else that kicks in that like the DSM just like doesn't talk about. Like, oh, you can't pay attention to the teacher disease. But it's right. And for, you know, for women or who tend to be under or who are underdiagnosed and tend to be misdiagnosed, the shame is compounded by like they got it wrong or they didn't notice it till later. So I've been white knuckling life for 28 years. And now you get that like, oh, you're in your 30s and now you're ADHD. Okay, honey. It's like, oh, no, you've been ADHD the whole time. But just now you're finally getting the resources and support you need.
That's right. And all along, having been told, you're wrong, you're too much, you're too sensitive, you're overthinking, and so on. Yeah, it's a very real thing. And I'm just so happy that you're here and aligned with the idea of taking down that shame by exposing what's real and what's true and how those things can actually be strategic assets when they're used right. I'd love to start with your own story and journey of neurodiversity. How did you first learn about your ADHD and how has that evolved for you over time?
Oh man. So I was identified gifted in second grade, as many students in public schools are. And looking back on it, I was definitely ADHD the whole time. But, I host a podcast and we had Joe Renzulli and Sally Reese on, and they're the godfather and godmother of gifted education. And but Sally was really the one of the first people to put the term twice exceptional out there, right? Gifted plus another learning difference. So both of my parents growing up were clinical psychologists, which is how they knew what to look for giftedness, right? They were like, oh yeah, wait, hold on a second, we know what this is. But my mom was like, no one said twice exceptional. That was not a term we used. So I bounded about through elementary, middle, and high school as like, I'm a smart kid. And then things got harder than I was smart. And then when I started to struggle, all of a sudden it was like, oh wait, he's been struggling with these things the whole time. I like to call it Wile E. Coyote syndrome. The old Looney Tunes where he'd run across the chasm and then he looks down and then he falls. Like, the more formal term for this in the field is the performance cliff. The idea is that, if you don't build the same skills other kids do, there comes a point where life gets harder than you are naturally smart. And when you have ADHD and that's hidden for whatever reason, recovering from that cliff is harder, right? So we've got people who are just doing the best they can, coming up with all sorts of coping strategies, some of which are adaptive and some of which are not so adaptive, right? In order to get the dopamine to get through the day. Well, I would rather center that conversation in good psychological science so we can open the right doors for people to get the help they need.
Absolutely. Yeah. That notion of finding the right doors and opening them is critical, and I think giftedness probably still is misunderstood. I know it was when my kids were in early elementary, it was just a couple of years ago. It's more than just taking tests well, more than just high scores and good grades. That's the definition that I think immediately pops to people's minds. But there's this whole other layer, or maybe several other layers to giftedness. Can you talk a little bit more about your understanding of that word, personally and professionally?
So, giftedness has this seat at the table for neurodivergence, right? It is literally a different brain. And we can see that on brain scans, both in terms of form and function. And but this represents sort of the inherent lag that exists in describing a thing we see in the world. This is a gifted learner. They get straight A's. They're going to Harvard. Right, or you're in Atlanta, Emory, right? We want to rep the South too. I won't, just don't ask me to say Duke and we'll be fine, okay?
Promise.
Yeah, right. You went to UNCG, you know what I'm talking about.
I do.
Right. So but then as our ability to scan the brain caught up with our diagnostic process, we started to realize that all these other things are part of that process, right? And if you think back to Lewis Terman's study, the longitudinal study of giftedness, the famous termite study, he was like, well, if these people are so smart, they are all going to be eminent. They're all going to be judges, lawyers, doctors, presidents, senators. And some of them were, but not all of them were. And then you start to realize that if giftedness is just intelligence, then it would be far more predictive of success in an American society that very much values excellence. But then there's clearly something else going on. And then we start to get into the social emotional aspects of giftedness, right? The right fit in the educational environment model. And all of those things become, they create artificial ceilings on a lot of people because, and it's made worse by the fact that you're putting these kids out there in a world that seems to like intentionally and aggressively misunderstand them.
Yes.
Like my colleagues in North Carolina, the name of their podcast is They'll Be Fine, because that's the common thing you hear when you're a parent of a gifted kiddo, and it's like, they'll be fine. Okay, but I wouldn't be talking to you if my kid was fine, right? Like, if I'm an adult and I don't fit in the world, I mean, I'm not fine. I need help. So, it's really like anchoring this conversation in neuroscience allows me to say to somebody like, this isn't just, oh, I'm smart and life's too hard for me. It is my brain works differently, and some of those strengths make things easier for me, but many of the other sides make life harder for me.
Exactly. Yeah. Speaking of that, how would a parent go about knowing or at least recognizing that there is something going on that may be giftedness or maybe something else? And once a parent recognizes that, what do they do next?
So, it's funny because this is going to sound like I'm contradicting myself a little bit. Because while giftedness is so much more than being smart and getting good grades, it is also often a thing we see first, right? One of the things about the American education system, right, is that it is built on redundancy. It is built on for and by neurotypical people. So really, the even number years in education are sort of, there's a lot of repetition from the odd numbered years. One of the reasons we test for giftedness in second grade is that second grade, in many ways, is sort of a deeper dive into first grade, right? So some of those concepts, if you master them in first grade, you don't really need the deep dive. So kids start to get bored, they start to act out, they start to showed the desire to move things forward, things more quickly. So if your kiddo was reading chapter books at the age of three, or if your kiddo has memorized every state capital, or your kiddo, like my son will correct my inaccurate pronunciations of dinosaurs. The other day I said Pachycephalosaurus, and he was like, it's Pachycephalosaurus. And I'm like, I felt like Hermione Granger. I'm like, regarding Leviosa. I'm like, oh my God, it's the dinosaur with the duck bill thing. Like, let's move on. But it's those sort of things. It's a, really giftedness is about intensity. It's intensity of relationships, intensity of thought, intentional feeling. So if your kid is just very intense and that intensity shows up in reading, writing, math, science, whatever, then it is worth checking with a professional to see what exactly does that mean.
Yeah, thank you for that. The intensity, I think, is a really important point. Do you? This was the case for my kids. They were really intense in certain areas, and then in others, really behind. Do you find that kind of spiky profile is sort of a tip off that maybe there's more going on than an average neurotypical kind of kid?
Absolutely. I mean, and the spikier the profile, the more likely we see that as a twice exceptional learner, right? Actually, like within the field, we often call it the ski slope, because people have super high verbal or nonverbal intelligence, but then like problem solving, working memory, and processing speed just slide down the side of the mountain. And this once again pushes back on one of those fundamental misunderstandings of giftedness. That well, they're good in everything. I'm a gifted adult. I built my whole professional identity about being gifted. But ask any of the kids in any of the schools I've worked in, I suck at coding. I am useless at coding. Like, I can't make the code monkey turn around. I can't make him pick up the banana. And the kids I'm with are like, just enter the code. And I understand the words you're saying. I mean, it's like, did you watch Schitt's Creek?
No, I didn't.
Well, there's this episode where the mom is saying to the son, like, just fold in the cheese. And he's like, what does that mean? You just fold it in. No, I heard you. But like, what does that mean, right? And I mean, thank goodness my strengths are in the reading, writing, art, humanities side. 'Cause yeah, my STEM stuff is not as strong. I'm perfectly fine at it, but so I'm not good at everything. But the spikiness of that profile can also show up outside of the academic intellectual space. We call this asynchronous development. The more neurodivergent you are, the more your developmental energy becomes split. So you may have a kid who's 10 years old, intellectually 17, and academically 16. You're like, oh yeah, my kid's crushing it. But since there's only so much developmental energy to go around, when some parts get a lot more logically, it's got to come. You're borrowing from Peter to pay Paul, right? So some kids get less, and they tend to show up less in life skills, social skills, and emotional skills. So you'll have a kid who's 10 years old physically, intellectually 17, but like socially 8 and emotionally 6. Right? So you need to find a way to fit an environment that's adaptable and flexible enough to that kiddo's needs to be able to pivot into a space that's more like, how do I give this kid the intellectual rigor while also supporting them that they're likely to melt down if they don't get their favorite kind of Pop-Tart?
It can be really hard to understand when a kid looks so advanced in one way and so regressive in another way. It's tough. I could
It's
talk
what,
about.
yeah, it's what makes meeting their needs so difficult because, as humans, right, we naturally pull ourselves up to the highest level of a kid's functionality, right? Like, oh, if you're 8-year-old, you're like, yes, I would trust my 8-year-old to pay my taxes. You're right. Like my 8-year-old's great at numbers. My 8-year-old would figure it out to get all my deductions, And you're like, so you naturally treat your 8-year-old more like an 18-year-old because if that's how they go. But when they have a huge meltdown or they can't get invited to a friend's house for a sleepover, A, we forget sometimes that's age normative behavior. 8-year-olds are not mature. They're not little adults. And also, then that's when asynchrony can show up where it's like, actually, being so good at some things often comes with the cost of being not so good at other things. And if you could take the whole neurodivergent experience, right, including our ADHDers, I think you can easily sum it up with the idea that hard things are easy for us and easy things are hard for us, right? If
A beautiful summary.
there is a medical crisis, I want an ADHD EMT, right? Like I am locked in. It's like the last season, it's like the last two episodes of The Pit, right? It's like I'm locked in. It's hyperstimulation, but I can lock in and do this. And it's like then you say that same ADHD or, hey, where are your car keys? And they're gonna sob on the ground for 45 minutes, right? And it's just like, and living in that is not only incredibly emotionally stressful because of the inconsistencies, but also there's that shame, right? How is it that I can cook a dinner party for 45 people with an hour's notice, but then I need to find my library book because it's been late for 2 months now and I can't find it. How do both of those parts of exist in my same brain? And since you've almost certainly been told the wrong things about how your brain works, you don't have the knowledge to reflect properly on what that actually means for you.
Perfect segue into what I'd love to talk about next, even though I could talk about kids all day long. Thinking now more about adults, and a couple of topics that show up often in your keynotes, like imposter syndrome and perfectionism. They seem like pretty insurmountable mindsets, and sometimes we can even find ways to make them feel useful. You know, imposter syndrome can keep us humble, for example, and Perfectionism can help us be super prepared for things. On the other hand, they can be pretty destructive. So if you are talking directly to the person listening right now who's feeling either or both of those things very deeply, what would you want them to know?
Well, I think we can boil basically everything in psychology down to the idea is that we name it to tame it, right? There, you know, parents will come to me all the time, like, I don't want my kid to be diagnosed. Like, I don't want my kid to be labeled. To which I almost always reply, you know, you're right. Hey, before I had the label of ADHD, I had other labels. Labels like space cadet, slacker, lazy, right? The world is going to label us whether we want it to or not. We might as well develop a counter narrative in our head based in good psychological science on what's actually going on. But the other power that shows up in naming things is when you didn't know a thing existed and you realize there's a term for it. There's a community that's been hidden from you the whole time. I mean, you know, I often joke about like one of my many neurodivergences is that I'm colorblind.
Oh.
Right? And we know that it's a scientific thing, right? My rods and cones don't send the right information via my optic nerve to my occipital lobe. Sure. But when you're 9 years old and you're a gifted kid and you can't tell colors apart, the word you give yourself is stupid.
Yep.
Right? I'm an idiot. I'm dumb. And when I found out that colorblindness was a thing, I burst into tears. I mean, you know, it's like not knowing you're lactose intolerant. Why do I vomit every time I have cheese, right?
You're What's stupid. Wrong with me?
Right, because in the absence of other information, your brain defaults to the only consistent piece of information it has, which is you, right? Yeah. You carry yourself wherever you go, Jess. I carry myself wherever I go. And like, so our brains are like, oh, it must be my fault, right? But if you're somebody for whom imposter syndrome is a thing, like, first off, neurodivergent people are significantly more likely to have imposter syndrome. Because imposter syndrome comes from a place you either are different or are made to feel different, right? And in neurodivergent people, that's both for us, right? We are different, and then we are often reminded of the things that make us different. Every time I wear a tie, I am reminded of the fact that I'm neurodivergent. Because I'm colorblind. But the other part of this is that knowing that it's a thing called imposter syndrome allows us to step out of the cycle in our brain that's like, and it's because you're broken or stupid or less than in some way.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. I'd love to talk a little bit about masking, especially in adult women with ADHD.
Yeah.
From your perspective as a clinician, what can that look and feel like? What are the dangers of masking? What are the upsides, if there are any?
So this is where I'm, I think, a little bit different than some of my colleagues who are providers. You know, I think that, see, what's the right way to say this? So masking is a coping skill, right? Masking is analogous to code switching, right? I'm not going to talk to you, someone I'm doing a professional conversation with and whom I barely know, the same way that I would talk to my best friend, right? That's a code switch. And to a certain extent, it's masking, right? Like if I have like a really off color joke banging around in my brain right now, I'd be like, hey Jess, can I tell something super offensive on your podcast? That'll be fun, right? Because like, I've got to acknowledge that different environments require different sets of skills.
Yeah.
But neurodivergent people tend to be what we call context independent. They are who they are all the time. Whereas neurotypical people tend to be very context dependent. You are going to be loud and rowdy at a pep rally and quiet and self-assured at, you know, at a workplace meeting and sad at a funeral and happy at a birthday party and stuff like that. Neurodivergent people, well, they may not feel the same way other people feel at those events, and they may have a more consistent emotional state, right? And masking is a way that we try to go along to get along. We try to get on rhythm with the neurotypical world as much as we can. And so some of my colleagues would be like, yeah, we want to teach people not to mask. And I'm like, not necessarily, right? There are times where masking is an appropriate social skill. There's times where masking is a survival skill. If I'm in a situation that is like aggressively anti-neurodivergent, I don't necessarily want to stand up on a table and be like, and I have ADHD. They might burn me at the stake, right? I mean, we've all seen Midsommar. We know how that story ends. So I tell my clients all the time is to be prudent, not paranoid. Right? So be prudent in how we show up and who we share our true selves with. And one of the things that's really interesting here, right, is somewhere between 38 and 70% of the neurodivergent population is also LGBTQ, right? So I always just say it's one and two. That makes the math a lot easier for me. One and two. And coming out as neurodivergent is very similar to coming out as being LGBTQ. And there are some spaces in this world that are not safe for our LGBTQ friends. And that breaks my heart. But there's a similar process, and there's been a really good academic research on this. Excuse me, that the process of coming out as gifted or dyslexic or autistic is very similar to that as coming out as gay, lesbian, trans, whatever it might be. So, we want to honor people's process with that, give them the privacy and the dignity that they deserve, because the analogous word to masking in the queer community is passing, right? So if you can pass as someone who you people are going to assume you're cisgender or heterosexual or whatever it is, there's privilege that comes with that, but there's also safety that comes with that, and one of my best friends from college, he came out when we were all seniors, and he's someone who has a lot of passing privilege. He looks like, if you pass him on the street, you're like, that looks like a straight man, right? Like he's built like a barrel. He has a lot of passion. But his husband is this very like flamboyant, openly gay. Like, I've been gay since I was 6 years old, right? And they're a fabulous couple, right? But it's the sort of thing, like he's like, when I walk with my husband, I lose all my passing privilege because it's very clear. Like, we're not just two straight dudes holding hands here, right? And so, I think a lot of people, and actually, not to follow this rabbit trail too far down, but it's interesting noting a lot of LGBTQ people in public education are really just kind of trying to survive. They're wrestling with who they are and identity and the social impacts of that, which may mean that they don't really sh let their sh light, true light shine in the classroom. I have a lot of queer people who come to me for therapy, and in the process of doing therapy, n managing what it's like to be queer in 2026, we're also like, have you ever considered that you're autistic? What? And then now we're having that conversation. So we can go one then the other, but it can just as easily go the other direction.
That is such an interesting and important perspective, I think. That sometimes masking can be adaptive when it is conducive to safety and belonging, I suppose. And maybe not belonging, maybe fitting in, at least in some ways.
I mean, I sure think so. I mean,
Yeah.
like, listen, I mean, like, yesterday I took my son to a birthday party, and I know these parents a little bit, right? Because our kids all go to the same kindergarten class. But I didn't go in there and be like, anybody want to talk about deep Star Wars canon? No? Oh. They're much more interested in talking about how the wrestling team at the high school is doing, right? And how about the weather? And I don't always find those conversations super engaging, right? But I also know that these are people, one way or another, I got to learn how to get along with, right? Like,
Mm-hmm.
there will be in my family's life in some capacity for the next 12 years. So I do, in those situations, I do a lot more listening than talking. People like to talk about themselves, so I will ask them questions. Turns out one of the guys is redoing his kitchen. I was like, man, that's a half hour right there. Boom, boom, boom. You granite countertops? Holy crap, tell me more. Like, and I just, right? And it's the sort of thing, like, it's part of being, there are times it makes you feel like a secret agent, right?
Yeah.
You're like behind enemy lines and you're like trying to figure this stuff out. But I genuinely, as much as I respect people who are just themselves in every situation, I don't always think it's the most adaptive pro-social technique. And having a therapist who's neurodivergent informed, like you and I are, gives people those the meta processing to understand, when can I be me? Because, like, honestly, if your partner is totally cool with you being ADHD, rock on. But if your mother-in-law needs you to be little Susie Homemaker, then we should have the conversation about what does that mean and how do you navigate those moments? Because I don't want you feeling you've got to be this way. I want you to be as nimble as possible, have as many options as possible.
Exactly. Yeah. And it occurs to me too that the ability to walk into a situation where being exactly who we really are may or may not be the best thing at the moment, it really plays into a lot of ADHD strengths, including generally being pretty intelligent, pretty sensitive, being able to read a room in an instant, and picking up on patterns and cues that other people might miss. Yeah, that's there's really no question there. It's just an interesting observation that I've noticed as you were talking.
Well,
That said, all of this masking, all of this trying to figure out what code is right for the moment can be exhausting.
yes.
And people get burned out from years of trying to make their mind behave in a way that it naturally doesn't really want to. When you encounter somebody like this, what are the very first steps you might take with them to help them shift into working with their mind instead of against it?
So probably the most foundational sentence in the neurodiversity movement is that differences aren't deficits. And I love leading with that with clients. So it's like, listen, you might be someone who needs a fidget to get through a lecture. Well, there's going to be a lot of lectures in your life. Let's use a fidget to get through those lectures so you don't make yourself miserable for the next 40 years of your life. You may be someone for whom paperwork is really difficult, and it is hard to live in life without paperwork, unfortunately. But you know what? It's 2026. We can hire you a virtual assistant. You can use AI. There's a lot of things you can do to limit those things. And so much of releasing the shame that comes with those struggles is like all you can do is meet yourself where you are and start from there. Right. And the more you know about asynchronous development and being neurodivergent and the science behind that, I think it allows you to approach those conversations not only from a place where you are much more informed about what's going on, you've got more science on your side, but also from a place of you're not personifying it. It's not, I am a scatterbrained and disorganized and poor time management. It's my prefrontal cortex is weaker because I'm neurodivergent. And here's what that means. And here's how I'm going to accommodate it. What I say to parents all the time is, and like, as we stagger out of the COVID years, it's a good example of this, right? If your kiddo didn't get to like have those sleepovers or scout meetings or soccer teams that other kids were because it was COVID and we're all basically locked inside, you're not going to grade that kid on the same scale as you would for a kid who got those experiences, right? I work with a family who just relocated from actually down by you. They're on the Alabama side. up to New England. And, and this kid's in high school. So basically, everybody in this kid's high school skis or snowboards.
Oh.
So they're like, well, you're 15. You want to be on the snowboard team. And he's like, I've never skied in my life. And they're like, but you're 15. He's like, and I lived in the South for most of my life, right? So, like, to teach him to snowboard, we have to start at the very, very, very beginning. Like, what is snow? Why are there mountains? I don't understand any of this. So, like, this is where, we get into the idea that the best practices for neurodivergent folks are just the best practices because it's based off what we call universal design. Meeting someone where they are, layering our interventions through their strengths and weaknesses and their likes and dislikes. This is a kid, if you had asked him 2 years ago, hey, do you want to learn how to ski? He's like, what's the point? I live in Alabama, right? Doesn't snow a whole lot down there in Alabama. But now that he lives in New England, it is a much more socially relevant thing for him to learn to do, right? So we've set him up with thank God, basically everybody who snowboards is ADHD. So we found him a really good teacher and he's learning, right? But the thing, we're not going to start him just where we think, giant air quotes, he should be, right? We're meeting where he's at. So, like, you might be the sort of person who can have a really deep, intellectually rigorous, fascinating conversation about, the works of Charles Dickens, right, or Virginia Woolf, right? But you also might be someone who really struggles to talk about local sports team or, can you believe what the scouts are up to? And it's like, I'm craving something deeper. Well, if you know that about yourself, it allows you to go along to get along where it's necessary, and then intentionally find spaces where you can do those deep dives. When I do my like a neurodivergent adult workshop, I always like to say, if you're going on a road trip, how many books do you bring? People look around and they're like, I don't want to. I was like, well, listen, this is a room full of neurodivergent people. How many books do you bring? And they're like, 15. I bring one Kindle of enjoyable books and one books of the academic tomes I'm reading. Like, and that's it. When one person shares, everybody else shares, and you realize, like, yes, we're all closet nerds, right? But if you're going on that same vacation with like your neurotypical neighbors because your kids are in softball together, you might not feel comfortable to bring, every single book in Heated Rivalry or the Dostoevsky in the original Russian because you're teaching yourself Russian for fun on the weekends. Like you, there's the masking sort of loops back in there. And I want you to be in as many places as possible where you can feel like the most authentic version of yourself. But you can only do that once you realize what those things are and what are the communities that emphasize those parts of you.
That makes perfect sense. I feel like the whole conversation that we've had to this point probably is a little bit of a preview into your book, The Neurodiversity Playbook. But I would be interested in hearing what compelled you to write it, who's it for, and who can it help?
Oh boy. So, when my editor asked me that question, I said, this book is for everyone who is neurodivergent, works with someone who's neurodivergent, or loves someone who's neurodivergent. And she's like,
Which is everybody.
exactly. She's like, I love that tagline. Wait, that's everyone. I'm like, ah, there we go. Right. Listen, one in five people are neurodivergent. There's a lot of us, right? This isn't one of those obscure diseases that has like 16 names because like five people on planet Earth have it. Like, it's a real thing. And, but the, I, you know, like the example I often use here, right? So just like if you were having a dinner party, right? We have 20 people coming to your house for dinner. What would you make?
I don't know. I would probably freeze and order out.
That's totally fine. What would you order? What would you order in?
Pasta, Italian.
Italian.
Everybody loves it.
Can't go wrong with Italian, right? And so we'll have a lot of pasta, we'll probably have a salad, right? And then I tell you, Jess, oh, I'm bringing my buddy from Atlanta and he's gluten free.
Oh
Right? Ah, panic. Now,
no.
here's the thing. Do you throw all that pasta in the garbage?
No.
No. What do you do?
Have an extra serving or three that's gluten-free.
There you go. And that's all neurodivergent people are asking for, is just let us have a seat at the table and let us have things we can access. Right? So I wrote this book to give people the tools to ask those questions and navigate those conversations. The reason I called it the playbook is that I wanted to write something that was very tangible and practical. Like, being an ADHDer from New Jersey, I'm often described as being aggressively pragmatic. I'm like, it's got to work. If it
Yep.
works, I will do it. If it doesn't work, I will not do it. And that's kind of what this book turned into. And there's a section there on how to make small talk. There's a section in there on like, why do you keep losing your car keys, right? And all of this gets into the idea is the world is not built for us or by us, but we are forced to navigate the world that was not built for us or by us. Now you can give up and throw your hands in the air and say, I'm going to move to the mountains and go off the grid. And if you do, tell me, because frankly, like it sounds increasingly good. There's no Twitter in the mountains. That would be probably a beneficial thing for my brain. So it's like, here's how you understand your brain to leverage its strengths and weaknesses to navigate situations that you must deal with to be a functional human in this in the world we live in.
I love that. That phrase that is often tossed around in education, the phrase special needs, it always has kind of rubbed me the wrong way because the needs of somebody who is neurodivergent are not special. They're the same needs everybody else has. We want to be loved and seen and accepted for who we are and feel like we're part of a community. We want meaningful work and so on. Special, it's what everybody wants.
Right.
So I really like that frame that you're putting on it, that we just want a seat at the table. We want access to things we can use. Very nice. So as we wrap up, Dr. Matt, I would love for you to think specifically about someone who is an adult, but just now beginning to understand that their intelligence and adaptability have kept their ADHD under wraps, maybe for decades. What do you want that person just beginning their journey to understand? And what's the first action you would encourage them to take?
Oh, that is a great question. So, if we can quote Maya Angelou, you do as well as you can until you know better, and then you do better, right? So, if we go back to being lactose intolerant, like, why do I always get sick to my stomach every time I eat ice cream? Then you realize that there's something called lactose intolerance, and then you realize you have it, and then you adapt your behavior based on that knowledge. Now that may not mean you never eat ice cream again, right? It just means you're going to be strategic about it. You take your lactate pills, but we cannot view anybody's journey without thinking about the intersectionality of who they are and how they bounce into the world they live in, right? And the realities are that women and people who are socialized female tend to have a less visible type of ADHD, and they're also socialized to go along to get along, right? So if you're a woman, or if you were socialized to be a woman, like you probably got some implicit and explicit cultural messages that you shouldn't take up that kind of space, and that's not your fault. There's a lot of going on there, right? But I mean, it's and like the intersectionality also includes where you're from, right? In the North, well, gosh, in New Jersey, like advocating for yourself is a varsity sport in high school, right? We all get varsity letters in that. But you went to college in North Carolina, you live in Atlanta, things are a little bit different,
Little different.
a little different, right? Just like they're different in Atlanta than they would be in sort of Macon or Augusta, right? I mean, the more things change, and I can give you the best advice for you based on what I know about you and your journey, right? And that's why like this stuff is so personal, and that's why it's hard for people to get their needs met, because it requires a certain amount of vulnerability to feel safe enough to say yes. Oh, and by the way, I grew up in a household where XYZ was true, and therefore I didn't do this thing. I can speak for all of our colleagues where it's like we are not in the position to judge anyone.
Right.
We are information holders. Tell me the thing, and it may matter, it may not matter, but I know the thing, and I will not judge you for the thing. And you know, there's and to be able to hold space for everyone's personal journey in that, I think really like a good example here, right? I work with a family. You know, they're in Greater New York City. And when they came to me because their kid was having significant GI distress, and it turns out that she had just had her third ulcer. Now, there's no 9-year-old girl in the world who should be having three ulcers, right?
Nine. Wow.
But it turns out her parents, who are both immigrants to this country and are very educated and very successful, were putting a lot of pressure on this little girl who was trying to also be very successful. And it would have been very easy to judge that family and come down on them like a sack of hammers. All they were doing was laying out the codes and rhythms that they grew up with and applying that to a world where, I mean, like, where, you know, it guarantees a certain amount of success. They just weren't thinking about the cost. But when they shared that with me, you know, it took several sessions for them to share that with me. I was like, I bet you think I'm going to judge you. I bet you think I'm going to yell at you. Now, like, don't get my heart is breaking for this kid. But let's assume positive intent here, folks. Like, let us assume that these parents didn't wake up in the morning and think, how do I help my daughter burn holes through her stomach lining? That's a Tuesday for me as a parent. No parent does that. No parent would do that. So that's where these conversations, I think, become really important from a place of curiosity and empathy. Because the more curious we are about what people bring to the table, we get to understand their journey from a place of empathy, and they're almost always going to do better when you are able to do that.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you so much for all of this, not just the wisdom and scientific knowledge and clinical background, but also the humor and empathy and strengths-based approach that you bring to all of this. I am imagining right now people listening and nodding along and smiling and feeling really accepted and heard and understood just from hearing your words. So thank you again.
Well, and you create the space where people can do that. I mean,
Thank you.
podcasts are a very safe way to take in a lot of information because you can do it on your own time. You can do it with your earphones on. So, like, that's a good thing. So I love that for us.
Thank you. It's, I hope it will reach many and be powerful for them.
Oh, I know it will.
For those who want to reach out, learn more about you, your practice, your book, and more, how can they find you?
So I have two primary roles, and I'm chronically online. So I say if you need me for your own ADHD journey, your own neurodivergence, then you know you'd contact us at the Neurodiversity Collective. That's the name of our practice. My colleagues and I try to be as much of a one-stop shop as we can. But you know, if you're hearing this, it's like, yes, I need a therapist who really gets adult ADHD. That's where we step in. But you know, as you said, I do some speaking. I'm often keynoting or flying places to give talks. So I would say if you need me for your organization, for your school, your community group, your company, then you reach out to drmattsukreski.com, and we would set up for me to do consultation or speaking, whatever it is, so for your organization. So basically, if this seems helpful, reach out and I'll point you in the right place, and we will help you live a life that is more authentic to who you are and more aligned with what you need.
Beautiful. Dr. Matt, thank you again. It's been really wonderful.
It absolutely has been. Thank you for having me.
Time for your lab kit. Three ideas from this episode that you can try in your own life starting today. Number one, name it to tame it. So I'd like you to pick one thing that you have previously labeled as a character flaw, an undesirable personality trait. First off, the very first step is to recognize this is not a character flaw. It's likely not a choice, and it's not something that's wrong with you. It's coming from a legitimate brain difference. I'd like you to research it. Talk to somebody else if you need to. Look on the internet, find out the real name, the real source of this particular trait or struggle that you've been thinking of. Because shame shrinks when evidence steps in. Once you can give it a name, you can begin to understand how to work with it instead of against it. Number two, stop throwing out the pasta. Think about where in your life that you're trying to rebuild a whole menu for a dinner party just to fit in. Instead, ask yourself, what small accommodation would give me a seat at the table? Maybe it's a fidget, maybe it's a timer, maybe it's a script for small talk. The idea here is to add support instead of erasing your whole self. Experiment number three, spot your Wile E. Coyote moment. Think about times in your life that you have been running along the ground, you run off the cliff and into the air. When did you finally look down? Identify one area where raw intelligence carried you until it didn't. And then ask, what skill did I never build up because I didn't need it yet? Recognize that that's not failure, that's the performance cliff. Build that missing skill up now without shame, knowing that you did the best you could until you couldn't. That's your lab kit for today. I hope you will pick one experiment and let me know how it goes. Thanks for listening to the ADHD Alchemy podcast. If you're nodding along and thinking, oh yeah, that's me, then please subscribe and share this episode with another woman who gets it. Your reviews help more women discover they're not failing. They're just wired differently. And that is a good thing, despite the challenges. Plus, I want to hear your story. Apply to be a guest at myadhdalchemy.com and join my free community at fitology.com/community. Those links will be in the show notes. Together, we can rewrite the ADHD shame story into one of strength. I'll see you next time.